Before we get started, there's something you should know about the Chonilla podcast. We like to cuss. And if you don't want your kids to hear it, then listen to us when they're not around. But if you don't mind your kids listening to grown folks talk, then turn this shit up and let the show begin. Welcome, everyone. You are listening to the Chonilla podcast. I'm Clove.
And I am Shirley, a.k.a. Jill Andrew. And you're listening to the Chonilla podcast, as you mentioned, the personal comedy journal of an interracial couple who explores the world from different perspectives and experiences.
And you are joining us today on Sunday, June 28th, 2020 at 1:02 p.m.
in the motherfucking Eastern time. Hey, Clove.
Yes.
You know my AKA?
Yes.
Jill Andrew.
Okay.
She is a Canadian politician. Happy Pride, y'all. And she represents the Black queer Canadian community.
That's great.
And she was elected to the Legislative Assembly of Ontario in 2018, provincial election. And she represents the electoral district of Toronto St. Paul's as a member of the Ontario NDP, New Dometic, oh my God, New Democratic Party. I got it out. But prior to her election in legislature, Andrew was a public speaker and activist. She co-founded the group Body Confidence Canada. So you need to check her out, Jill Andrew, which is her on Twitter or on Instagram. It's Jill's Last Word, at Jill's Last Word. Today, I'm super excited. We have our first guest since our comeback on the Chonilla podcast. Is it goes like comeback? Okay. And super excited to have Sarah Swain from the Great Canadian Woman podcast and community. Sarah founded the community back in 2018, where she attended an event in Southern California, and she bumped into hundreds of Canadian women. And what was puzzling to her is that she didn't even know about any of these women and businesses, many of them that they created. So it dawned to her, that often Canadians, we get drowned out on the, on the international stage. So she figured of, a new way to connect. So the podcast started, which launched on Canada Day itself. And when the Great Canadian Woman hits the ears of Canadians, the word spread quickly like wildfire, and a community started to form.
That's great.
It's now listened to in over 75 countries and downloaded over 1,000 times per week. One thing that's inevitable that led to another is that the Great Canadian Woman now boasts a chart-topping podcast. It's grown a rapidly growing annual summit and now a book that features amazing Canadian stories of women. So I'm super excited to have Sarah on the show. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Yay.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, guys. I'm so jazzed to be here.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Sarah and I we spoke back in a year ago.
Yeah.
Yes. You reached out, DM me from the Black Canadian Content Creators Instagram, and we just kind of built, a friendship, an e-friendship.
Yes. I like that.
But I would love, also, I had the pleasure to be on Sarah's show 2 weeks ago. She started an amazing series, Uncomfortable Conversation. And it was truly an experience. And but before we get to how you got the idea to create this series through your show, let's start to get to know you more. Like, where are you from?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question.
I know, right? We all know we're from Canada.
Let's start way back. I was actually born in Sudbury, Ontario. So about 5 hours northwest of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And when I was 19, headed down to the GTA. I lived in the Toronto area for about 8 years. That's where I met my now husband. He's from Whitby, Ontario. And then we headed west. We did about 6 years in Edmonton. We did about a year and a half out in Moncton, New Brunswick, out on the East Coast. Oh, wow. And now we're back in Calgary, Alberta. And I think this is where we're going to stay.
Yeah, for good.
We're done moving now. Yeah. But I've been everywhere.
Good.
What made you decide to stay in where you are now near Calgary?
There's something about the land here. The mountains, it sounds so cheesy, but they literally call us. And it's where we feel the most at ease, the most peace. Anytime I need clarity, anytime I need some sort of soul healing or just rest, I go there and they give that to me every single time. So to be far from them just doesn't make sense. But we had to leave Alberta and try something else in order to understand that Alberta is where we really, really want to be. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't come out to Alberta originally by choice. We came out, my husband got an opportunity with the federal government. And so when we got here, we kind of didn't think that we were here by choice. We didn't know if we wanted to be here. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we left. And it was only a handful of months after we left that we realized that we were homesick. Oh my God. But we weren't homesick for Ontario, which was weird because that's where we're both from. Mm-hmm. We were both aching to get back to Alberta and get closer to the mountains again. So here we are.
You're saying, huh? Because we used to live in Edmonton. Because again, my hubby too, his work. And we were planning or thinking to be there for a good 5 years and then get a sense of, okay, how do we feel after 5 years? Yeah. But after 3 years, I was like, nope, I'm done.
Yeah. Get me out of here.
Get me out of here. It's cold.
Yeah. You know, the winters there are no joke.
Yeah.
We at least down here, we've got the Chinooks that come in. So it's a totally different climate down here in Calgary than it was in Edmonton. I remember our first winter, we had no idea. And you know, I was born and raised in Northern Ontario. Snow was just a part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That first winter, we're like, what the heck have we done?
Yeah, we had the same experience. It's like, whoop.
Yeah. But one thing I do miss about Edmonton is the people are like, there's a sense of neighborliness, if that's even a word, that I miss, you know, where people like, let's exchange keys. If something happened, neighbor, you got my keys. And I was like, okay, that's okay. For me, that was strange coming from growing up in big cities. Like I grew up in Montreal and Toronto. So that was like, okay, sure, we'll exchange keys.
When you do a key exchange, does anybody ever really check if the keys work?
Great question. I never have. I just assume it does.
Same here. And I'm giving away my keys to a door that I haven't even tested.
Yeah, you're right.
That's hilarious. Yeah, no, we did the same thing. We had we had lived in a little cul-de-sac, and everybody in our neighborhood, we all had access to each other's homes. We all shoveled each other's driveways if someone was working late. Like, it was just
nice.
Such a different vibe.
It is. I miss that. I miss this. There's this sense that, like, people also love. I don't know if in other, like, if it's like that in BC or Manitoba or whatever, but I get the sense in Alberta too. People love, like, having parties in homes. Like, I feel like in Ontario, people just like, no, I need to book a space.
And it's got to spill outside.
Right?
Yeah, big venues, big extravagant ordeals. And yeah, in Alberta, people just kind of have big house gatherings and barbecues and street parties.
Yes.
Walk off the street. No one can come in. Everyone's set up on the street there with their lawn chairs.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little more simple, I guess, eh?
Yeah, for sure. So when you were a kid growing up in Sudbury, what were you into? What kind of, like, what were you dreaming about, like, that you're going to be as an adult? And what kind of games did you play?
Oh, my God. So I grew up, so Sudbury's where I was physically born. That's a hospital. But yeah. I lived another hour or so west in a tiny town called Massey, Ontario, 1,100 people.
Oh, wow.
And we lived outside that town on a dirt road. So about 10 kilometers down a dirt road outside of a teeny tiny town. I grew up in the middle of a forest.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, my whole life, my whole childhood was outside. That was all I knew. And My parents had a lot of property. The land is so cheap up there that you can just get acres and acres and acres of land. So I just thought that that was normal, to just be able to go outside and play and, you know, be safe, not fearful of the outdoors, not fearful of bears, but be aware and be safe and be practical. But fishing, snowmobiling, ice fishing, gosh, what else? Boating, just driving through the forest on my dad's ATV. Like that was just
sounds like fun.
How I grew up.
Are they
I was
still
exposed
there?
To the city because both my parents are from Toronto, actually.
Oh.
So all of my aunts, uncles, cousins, grandmothers, they were down in the GTA. So my mom would bring me down there to visit. But I think she was also trying to help me see that there's another world out there outside of my little, you know, rural bubble that I was in so that it wouldn't be so shocking to me, you know, when, you know, I grew up and did whatever I wanted to do and all of a sudden be around millions of people for the first time ever. So, you know, I loved going to Toronto as a kid, which is why I think I moved there when, you know, I was old enough to move out. And I packed up my U-Haul. I had a little orange cat named Stanley at the time. And we drove down, me and my cat Stanley drove all the way down from Northern Ontario to my condo in Scarborough and started my adult life there.
Nice.
And so when you moved with your cat Stanley, did you move because did you have a job already ready for you, or, you know, did you start looking?
Yeah, I was going to university. I was at University of Toronto Scarborough campus.
Okay.
So I was there, but this was my second round of university. I did a year in North Bay, Nipissing University in business administration. I'm like, nope, that's not it. And decided to take journalism and political science at U of T, and that wasn't it either. And I ended up actually graduating college, Centennial College, the one at Markham and 401 there, in police foundations, because I was going to become a police officer.
Really?
Yeah.
And
the layers.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Careful.
So what made you think to become a police officer? It's funny you say that, because I consider that too myself, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. Like, yeah. I knew what I wanted to do, but to be real, I was afraid to go for it. So I figured the easiest thing to do is I'll become a police officer. I thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, because I think that there was a part of it for myself where I'm like, I don't know what to do. I keep trying all these things. And I was actually up in Barrie visiting my cousin. They had just had little twin girls, and her husband is an officer with York Region, and he came home after a night shift. I was out on the porch having coffee, and it just kind of like, huh, you know, I could see myself doing that. And, you know, it was at the time a highly sought after type of career. You know, it was more, you know, respectable and commendable to go into that line of work. It was considered secure. I'm like, well, it just kind of makes sense. And I'm capable of doing those types of things. I grew up rural. We had a shooting range on our property, so I grew up very familiar with firearms. My dad's a firearms instructor too. So I thought, why not? So I enrolled myself in Centennial, and I was there for 2 years, graduated, and started doing security work to gain experience. And that's ultimately how I end up in this whirlwind of a corporate retail career for over a decade. I have the most bizarre history of I'm all over Canada. I'm all over in my career path. And I joke often that I had to take this really long, windy route to help me figure out what I actually want to be doing. But yeah, I've definitely dabbled in a lot. I never ended up going into police college. I graduated educationally, but never actually applied.
So you're doing security, and then you just kind of move your way up in the retail industry?
Yeah, I did actually a couple of like actual uniform security jobs to gain experience. I did Sick Kids Hospital for a while, did security work there. And I ended up in retail because I went into loss prevention. Oh, so okay. I was the undercover, you know, shoplifter catcher person.
Oh, nice.
And yeah. I did that for, oh my God, I want to say at least three years.
What was the weirdest like shoplifting where you're like, oh boy, like what was like?
There are so many, like it's shocking. Like I think about it now and I'm like, that was the most dangerous thing I could have ever done. Cause we didn't have any type of, you know, real training or, you know, people would pull weapons on us. It was
really
nuts. But this one woman stands out to me, and I've forgotten her name now because it's well over a decade.
Yeah.
But she was this 76-year-old woman who was visiting her daughter, and I think she was visiting from Iran, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But I got her twice. She came back again. And she fought me both times. Fought me. Like
wrestle. Out,
trying to attack me. Yep. Oh. You know, you want to be able to control the situation, but she's got these little tiny wrists, and you know, so it was a lot of call it verbal,
yeah,
strong verbal negotiating to get this woman to hand over. She would load up bags, thousands of dollars worth of merchandise, and she would try and scurry out the door. I'll never forget her. I've got some stories though, that's for sure.
So you move up in retail, and then yeah. your last like corporate gig was as a regional director.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was that like? How did
stressful.
You be- Yeah.
Stressful. When you're in sales in a corporate setting, the pressure is on. Mm-hmm. And you know, I eventually got out of loss prevention. I knew at that point my career grew so fast that it actually financially didn't make sense for me to become a police officer. I would have been taking such a cut to go into entry-level policing that I'm like, well, I may as well just stay here and see what this career has to offer me. So I took all sorts of different positions just in about every different type of retail aspect that you get: front of house, back of house, logistics, policy, sales, marketing, running actual stores, a store manager. And it was that experience that I think that allowed me to get a job like a regional director at my age. I was about 30 when I took it.
Oh, wow.
And my counterparts were all 10, 20 years my senior. Mm-hmm. So I think it's because I had so much experience in about a 10-year span that it qualified me to take on the role. But it was also a bit of a tipping point for me to, you know, either shit or get off the pot with all these business ideas that I was going to have that I wanted to do. It was just stressful enough to push me past my limit to say, I got to do something else with my life.
When you were figuring out like you wanted to do something else, is that when you went to that event, like in Southern California? What was that event? Because I've heard of this event before.
Yeah, it was Lori Harter's Bliss Project. And it was in... what's the place outside LA? Newport Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And I went 2 months after I quit my job. I just quit. I went on a stress leave, and I was about 2 weeks into my stress leave that I just had this, you know, for lack of a better word, it was like an awakening that within 2 weeks I felt so much better.
Mm-hmm.
That I realized just how run down I was in my career. And I'm like, I can't consciously go back to that lifestyle and that level of stress and that strain that it was putting on our marriage, me being on the road in airports and hotels all the time. So yeah, it was about 2 weeks after. So I let the Christmas season pass, and it was January 6th. I handed in my letter of resignation to my employer saying I'm not returning for my leave. I had no backup plan. Nothing.
Were they surprised? Did they ask you like, where are you going?
Oh yeah. They could not understand because I didn't have another job to go to. I was just out, but I was also one of their top performers, that they had in line for succession planning to take over my boss, who was a divisional VP at the time. So it was jolting to them that, you know, one of their best candidates was just out, like up and leaving, no backup plan. I think they probably thought that I had really kind of went a little nutty at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I left my husband, poor guy, just barely mentally survived that decision that I made.
Was he shocked too, or?
Oh my God. Yeah. It wasn't that he was shocked. It was that he couldn't understand, and Clove, maybe you can weigh on this too. It's like the difference between the man's brain and the woman's brain, where he would say, I don't understand why you can't just go to work, shut it off, and then do your thing and then come home and be fine at the end of the day. And you shut it off. I'm like, I can't. It's because I take it with me. I take the worry. I take the stress. I take the planning. I'm constantly thinking about all the things that are coming up. It's like there's no off button, right? I'm like, I can't just unplug.
Yeah, I relate.
Step into another part of my brain and then do something and then go back into the other part of my brain when I'm at home. I just can't do it.
Yeah, I relate more to not being able to switch my brain off.
Really?
Then, oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Where were you when I was explaining this to my husband 3 years ago? it was a tough time in our marriage.
Oh, no doubt.
Because all I told him was like, I'm like, I know I can create something. I know I'm capable of doing it. I have so many skills. I have work ethic like no other.
Yeah.
If I work this hard for a company that I really don't even benefit from in an industry that I really don't even care about, what would I be capable of doing for something I actually really was passionate about, right?
Right.
But to him, there was nothing tangible. There was like, I was just this idea and a fierce sense of trust that I had in myself.
Yeah, and some people just don't get the need to create.
That's right.
No.
Yep.
Yeah. Everyone's built differently.
Yep.
So how did you, you quit your job 2 weeks later. How were you, it sounds to me like after you quit, or maybe just before deciding to quit, were you looking at alternatives and then that's how you found out about this event? Or
it was probably, I want to say, that was what, beginning of 2018. I started in 2014, I want to say, in the network marketing industry. I started using products that one of my friends kept hounding me to buy.
Melaleuca? And, is it Avon?
No, it was the Isagenix.
Is it Herbalife?
Same thing. She was after me for a year, and I finally said, fine, I'll buy your damn shake.
Here's some money, go away.
Yeah, exactly. But then I ended up loving them, and then I started to look at the business side of things, and I was blown away because at that point in my life, all I ever understood was traditional career options.
Yeah.
I didn't know that there was other ways of creating your lifestyle or, you know, designing a life that really suits how you want to feel instead of, you know, checks off all the success boxes that we're told we have to check off. Mm. You know? Right. And that was like a little portal opened for me. Just dabbling in network marketing. I never took it completely seriously. I sold shakes here and there, but never full on going for it. But it was that world that opened me up to personal development and starting to read books and, you know, starting to work on my mindset. So it's like there was kind of this couple of years where I had really put a lot of intentional work into my own self-belief. So leading up to me quitting, I felt very strong, even though, you know, stress-wise and emotionally, I was not on point. I was not at my best, but I just had this underlying belief that I'll figure this out. I don't know what it is, but I'll figure it out. So that's how I knew of this event, was just through that whole world of network marketing that bled into all this personal development. So I bought myself a plane ticket when I had no job. I'm like, well, I guess we're just going to see what happens here. But that was a pivotal point for sure.
So you're at the event and then you're discovering like, oh, wow, there are so many, not just Canadian women out here that you didn't know about, and you're discovering that they are their journey in businesses.
Yeah. It was like another whole world opened up for me, because being in Canada and I think about the circle I was running with at the time, very corporate driven. Mm. So it never seemed like there was anyone that thought differently than me about what's possible career and lifestyle wise. So all of a sudden I'm at this event and there's all these people that are just kind of designing their lives and making businesses. And I'm like, you're all Canadian? Like, I didn't think that there was anyone in Canada that thought like this, right? I thought I was like this weird one, because in my social group, I was the weird one.
Right.
Who, you know, is kind of seen as like this defector, where it's like, oh, she's, you know, throwing away this lifestyle of hers because she wants something greater, right? So I felt very misunderstood about the things that I wanted to do with my life and what I thought was possible for myself and for people if they just believed in themselves a little bit more. So when I ran into all these people, and I think it was on the second day or something, because word started to get out that there's so many Canadians here and we're all networking with each other because we're mingling at the evening events and stuff. The host, Lori Harder from the stage, said, you know, how many Canadians are here? And it sounded like the whole room just lit up.
Really?
And I was like, what the heck is going on? And like, one part of me, it's like, okay, well, it is the middle of February and we probably are trying to escape Canada
right cold.
Now. Right.
Yeah. Probably just all needed a vacation. But, you know, there were speakers on the stage that were Canadian. And I'm like, there's something going on here. This just doesn't make sense to me anymore. And it was one of those things. It would not let up. I could not stop thinking about, and I was telling everyone when I got back, I'm like, there's people down there. Like, I wasn't the only Canadian that went. There's other people from Canada that went, and they're incredible people doing amazing things. And I had all these new connections. And then again, it's like another little door opened up that stretched the possibility a little bit more. And that's what planted the seed for the Great Canadian Woman.
Now, did the Great Canadian Woman just come to you, or did you feel like after the event, like, I want to do something, but I'm not quite sure? Like, how were you, did you even think of it that you wanted a podcast or a community, or how did this come about?
Yeah, it was more when I left, it's like, how do I connect us all? How do I get more women to know about what other Canadian women are doing, what they're creating, if they've got podcasts or if they've got books or businesses or just really powerful stories? How do I get everybody together? And it was several weeks of just these little thoughts kind of collecting over time. And then I can't remember what the hell I was doing, but it was a very clear download, just that the Great Canadian Woman. I'm like, okay, that's terrifying. But it felt very aligned with my idea of the space that I wanted to create. And at the beginning of the year, because I'm such a planner, 2020 is really throwing me for a loop because I feel like I can't plan anything right now, like more than 2 weeks out. Typically, I've got 12 to 18 months ahead where I know what's going on. So in my first year of business, I had June 30th as a date that I was going to launch a podcast by, even though when I set that date, I had no idea what it was going to be about or what it was going to be for. I'm like, I just know I'm going to start a podcast. And then it was that date, which was the day before Canada Day, mixed with the idea of the Great Canadian Woman. I was like, oh, this is the podcast that I'm supposed to launch. And that's what I did. I just started a podcast because at that time I was supplementing my income by doing empowerment coaching and confidence building with women. So I kind of had a little bit of a business kind of starting to build. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until the podcast started that I started to get traction, but kind of in another way that I wasn't expecting.
And how did you already, because you're saying, you know, you plan ahead, did you already know who you wanted to reach out, or basically just you're hitting the list from the event?
You know, it's so cringy because I think about the first episode that I recorded, and all I was talking about was like the rolling hills of the prairies and the mountains of the west and the ocean. Like, it's just the worst thing you'll ever listen to. I had no idea what the podcast was even going to be about, but I'm the type of person where it's like, just start doing something.
Yeah.
And trust yourself to figure it out along the way, instead of waiting for all this beautiful clarity to figure out who is this for and who am I going to talk to. It's like, I'm just going to throw myself in.
Right.
So I did. So the first couple episodes, I'm like, ooh. But yeah, then I just started reaching out to people in my network, people who I had met at the event, and just started having conversations. But at that time, it was really focused more on Canadian entrepreneurs. than just Canadian women in general, which has been a big shift within the last year. As I removed kind of the business side of me out of the Great Canadian Woman and kind of opened up my own business coaching practice on the side to alleviate that need within me. Mm. And then allow the Great Canadian Woman to become more all encompassing of not just Canadian women in business, but Canadian women in general.
And then, so once you've shifted that, is that when you saw that the community was just growing or a community was forming?
It definitely took on another level of power when I brought into the focus and took the podcast from prior to that, I was recording once a week myself, a solo episode, and then I would have a guest on every week. So we're doing about 2 episodes a week fairly consistently. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I took my solo voice out, because I was always very business driven, right? So I think a lot of my content was only really interesting to a select few out of the whole population, right? It wasn't until I removed myself and I opened it up to the contributor style platform on the podcast where Canadian women can apply to be on the show. They get 20 minutes of airtime and they get to talk about what they want to talk about. Oh, wow. So it really gave the voice and the mic back to Canadian women. And it was that, you can see it in my stats. It's like, that was a defining moment and decision to take the podcast in that direction and truly start to build a community as opposed to this space that was kind of led by one person. That's the thing that happened at the beginning of this year, just in January, that just shifted everything. And we started picking up crazy traction on the podcast and we couldn't keep up with the applications.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Great problem to have. One that still needed to be solved.
And so as you're doing that and you're shifting and you're not only shifting the spotlight in a way and the platform, when did you come about? Was that around the time that you decided to create the summit, or was that someone who listened that suggested to create the summit, or like, were you getting that kind of feedback? Like, hey, let's do a meetup or something.
Yeah, it actually started right around the time when I launched the podcast. But my coaching business, my empowerment coaching business that I was kind of dabbling in when I left my job, it was called Life Intentionally. Mm-hmm. And it was that group of beautiful women who had gathered in that space that said, you know, it would be really awesome if we could all get together. Because so many of them had never met. They're, you know, just meeting because they're in the Facebook group or meeting because they're clients of mine, never actually meeting in person. So the first gathering I had was in, we did it in Vaughan. Mm-hmm. And it was called the Life Intentionally Summit. But as I was planning this get together, it was so small. It was like maybe 40 people or so. It was my first one. I was so, so excited. And it was while I was planning this that the Great Canadian Woman in the background was kind of starting to pick up momentum. Mm. And I actually announced at that first event that I was rebranding my entire business under the Great Canadian Woman platform. And the one that we had in 2019 was technically the first Great Canadian Woman Summit under the Great Canadian Woman name and banner. Mm-hmm. And then the one that was supposed to be this October out here in Alberta in 2020 would be the second annual summit, but that's not till 2021 now.
And was summit purposely like you were choosing, you know, who were part of the summit? Like how was it a theme specifically, or was it just like, okay, here are these great women. They have great knowledge that people can learn from.
Yeah, it was very broad. It was about who do I know in my network that can come together and put on a really powerful experience for the people who purchased tickets. And my network had grown so much since I launched the podcast, because anytime I had a guest episode, they'd be sharing it on their platforms. And that's what really kind of snowballed the growth of the podcast, and then also the number of people that I was starting to come to know in Canada, which was exactly my point.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the first one was all about, all right, who's here and how do we get people to come into this space? And the first event we had just under 100 ticket sales. And that one was in Muskoka, Ontario. Yeah, it wasn't necessarily business focused. It was more just general women's empowerment. And people would come for all sorts of different reasons. Some people did come because they needed that to be able to help themselves in their business from a mindset standpoint. Others came because they just wanted the networking aspect.
Yeah.
So it was very vague. Again, it's one of those things where it's like, let's launch it. Let's throw it out there and see what happens, get the feedback and see what this looks like for the following year.
So, so as you're saying, let's launch it, get the feedback, you got a different feedback,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. So you're looking, you're saying great Canadian women, this is for women, but someone pointed out in your feedback, yeah. okay, I see you're building this summit, but I'm a Black woman and how come there's no women that look like me in yeah. in this? What did yeah. you think when that feedback came to you?
I was devastated. It's interesting because it's not necessarily something I was shocked by, because when I chose the name The Great Canadian Woman, it scared me because I knew, like internally, I knew that as one solo white woman, I was gonna be up against a big hill trying to figure out how to represent Canadian women.
So, and did you deeply know, like it's almost like subconscious, like you knew, but were you afraid to kind of look at that or realize that too?
Yeah, it's like I was afraid because I didn't know how or where to start, because my network has been predominantly white my entire life. And it's like realizing how, as soon as my fear was that if I had someone who was Black or Indigenous or of color, then there was going to be someone else, another group or community that I was still leaving out. So it's like, my thought process at the time was to allow it to be very organic and see who comes into the space. But the problem was, is that it was just only white people that kept coming into the space. So when it was the first comment I had, it was actually on a speaker's post that she had made saying she's going to be a speaker at the summit.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Black man out of Montreal that commented saying, hey, you know, this looks really great, but I'm noticing that there's not any Black women on the panel. And it's like, I think it's stung for a couple of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It stung because I knew that this was something that I needed to be doing, but hadn't taken action on it yet. So there was a part of myself that I was irritated with. For letting it get to the point where now this is becoming a thing that people are noticing. And the other part that was upsetting to me was that the last thing I wanted anyone to think was that people were not welcome in my community.
Right.
And that's where I really, really struggled with not knowing how to, you know, help everyone feel welcome, but then feeling torn because I knew that by doing nothing was only just continuing to make a white community even bigger.
Yep.
It intimidated the hell out of me. I literally did not know what to do.
Did you feel like at first, because I remember when we spoke, you mentioned like your first reaction was like, oh my gosh.
Fragility.
Yeah, well, now I know what that means. If you had told me back then that like my, you know, quote unquote, my white fragility was showing because I was upset, I would have been so offended by that too,
oh, yeah.
you know, because
oh, yeah.
I didn't get it. I'm like, what do you mean I'm fragile? Like, that was offensive to me because I consider myself to be strong as hell. So to have the word fragile associated with me in any way was incredibly off-putting. And I think that's why it took me this long to be able to be open to the idea of it, because I wanted to completely dissociate myself from the idea of, you know, being a fragile white person, because the concept hadn't landed yet. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah. So you're thinking, I love this part too, when you've mentioned the story, is that as you're feeling this, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like, look, like, this great Canadian woman. I mean, it's Canadian.
It's for all women.
It's for everybody.
Why don't you get it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not my fault there's only white people joining my group.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
that was a defense. That was a very valid defense in my own thought process. That it's like, well, I can't control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feels like they can come in or not.
Yeah.
And then you spoke to your sister and you start, like, when that first came, were you talking to the people who are you closest, obviously your husband? Like, what did you say to your husband? What did you say to your sister? Like, were you like, can you believe this?
Yeah. I was basically like, can you believe that people would actually think the great Canadian woman isn't inclusive? Like, can you believe that people would, for like a hot second, think that I would not welcome anyone coming into the space with open arms? And then it was met like my, you know, I talked to my mom, my sister, and they'd be like, yeah, you know, like, you're not like that. And I don't understand why everyone doesn't understand this too. And they're not welcome. And like, they were trying to get me to not be so hard on myself.
Right.
So it was just like white people fueling white dialogue.
Oh yeah. There it is.
You know, I can see it now, but at the time I'm like, I just was so lost, so oblivious to how to navigate the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But your sister said something that was really poignant to you, because I remember when we spoke and I asked you, like, when did it click? Did you have a question?
I just wanted to make sure that it's okay that we talk about this.
Yes.
So make sure, yeah.
Okay.
We're good.
Okay.
when did open
book here.
Yes. When did it click? You know, what made you kind of, okay, everyone's around you like, yeah, like, what the heck, right? But when did you start taking a moment to just, wait a minute, like, why?
Yeah, what if some people are feeling excluded?
Right. How did even that come about in order to ask that very question?
Yeah.
I think there was a couple of things at play. One was the amount of personal development I had done on myself up to that point really played a role here, because I recognized that I was triggered as hell.
Right.
And I know that when I'm triggered, it means that there's something there that needs to be addressed. Because if it had just been like, oh, hey, yeah, you're right, totally, I need to work on this, and, you know, I'm going to try and do whatever I can to make sure that you do feel welcome, that wasn't my response. My response was defense.
Mm-hmm.
And just really losing sleep over this. Like, it was that upsetting to me that I was losing sleep. Mm-hmm. It was that stressful for me. So I knew that there was something there that was really poking at me.
Right.
And I think the other aspect that helped was starting to open up dialogue with a friend of mine who was also on the podcast in its first year. Her name's Crystal Hardy. Her indigenous name is Zhongwe Banisekwe. And we had a really beautiful conversation about how we start to get white people and indigenous people to connect more. And that dialogue in that podcast episode started to help me understand why indigenous people, because I was being met with all sorts of anger when I tried to bring the indigenous community into the space, a lot of anger. Like, it wasn't just like, hey, no, I'm not really interested, it's not my jam. It's like, don't talk to me. I will never identify with being a Canadian woman. Wow. And it's like,
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
So there was that small experience that I had mixed with the fact that I knew I was sitting with a lot of, you know, lack of settling feeling in myself. I'm like, okay,
so
this is something that I have to start exploring, so, not just for the sake of doing it, but for the sake of me understanding it.
Just so I understand, you reached out to Indigenous women to ask them to be a part of your group, and they were like, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. We had some who were like, yeah, this is really great, but it's interesting. And again, I can't speak on their behalf, but based on the conversations I had, the Indigenous peoples who I had these conversations with were more inclined and more interested in what I was doing if either A, they were raised by white parents, or they were in a relationship with a white person.
Yo, that's real.
That's, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was kind of all that stuff going on. And I'm like, oh boy. And this was, you know, going back to the conversation I had with my sister when I first chose the name, like you were just mentioning. Mm-hmm. And I had that like internal fear, right? I'm like, this is a big name to take on. And I was chatting with my sister. She's almost 9 years younger than me. And I was just over text. She was living out on the East Coast at the time. I was still in Alberta. I'm like, I don't think I can take on this name. Like, I don't think that I am going to be able to do it justice. And I had some other, I can't even remember. It was like something soulful, something whimsical like that.
Soulful Canuck.
Like,
no, I'm kidding.
Soulful Canuck. That's the best. I might actually open up a sub business. Give you credit for it.
Nice.
Yeah, like I was talking to her and I'm like, I don't think I can do this. I'm like, here's the other name I'm toying with. And she called me out on it straight up. She's like, if roles were reversed right now, you know, you would be telling me that this is fear that you're up against. And, you know, because she was in college, so she was always calling her big sister and navigating life things and relationship things. So I was kind of always that person to help her through all the stuff. And then the tables had turned in that conversation. So she, you know, just helped me realize that, yeah, I was terrified to take it on, but typically that's a sign that you need to do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like internally the whole time I knew that if I was going to really do this, I was going to have to really do this instead of just, you know, falling back on what I now understand is what most white female platform creators have done, is just hope that everyone comes in and hope that everyone feels welcome. And, you know, that only lasted for about a year before I'm like, yeah, this isn't good. This isn't going to work. So that's when I reached out to you. That's when I started opening up the dialogue, but it's like everything that happened this year just like ripped the lid of the can right off because it landed. And I think that's where I had a difficult time because I still didn't understand why I had to do it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Like I knew I had to do it. I knew I had to diversify and I knew I had to, you know, make sure everyone felt included, but I still didn't understand it. Not to the level that I do now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because all of my efforts up until this year to diversify the platform had been, you know, for the sake of doing the right thing, but it not actually being connected to my heart space and like feeling a burning desire to do the right thing.
Yeah. You can do the right thing for the wrong reason, for sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. And that's why it's like we'd make a little progress and then, okay, we're still not where we need to be. But now I can hear it in my thoughts now. Whereas before, I mean, yeah, I did all the things. I started talking to people. I implemented a diversity committee. And I'm like, okay, we're making traction here. Like we're doing things better. And I was really proud of that. But I still wasn't seeing anyone else coming into my community
right.
That wasn't white. So I'm like, okay, but I'm doing all the things and it's
inviting people. Yeah,
I did all the checks. I hit all the check marks.
Yeah. But it's yeah. I'm so glad we're talking about this, because what you're going through, I think there's a lot of brands that are about to go through this or is starting to go through this, because like one of the things is, you know, after George Floyd, may he rest in peace, it really sparked the movement again.
Yeah.
And then you started seeing a lot of either communities or we'll focus on big brands saying, hey, we're in solidarity, racism is wrong, da 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 da. But doing so, it's putting it outwardly. And it sounds like it's like that's what you did. You're inviting people, hey, come, let's, you know, you want to talk about this, I'll have you, you know, on my show. But no one's looking internally. And right now, that's what's happening with brands, right? They're being called out. Like, okay, it's great you're showing on Twitter or whatever, or Blackout Tuesday solidarity. But what do you look like internally? Most importantly, have you done the work internally?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that because I felt it. It was, I don't even know how to describe the switch that happened, where it's like, holy shit. Like all of a sudden I saw it in a way that I never saw it before. And the tidal wave of guilt and shame and embarrassment that was like, it overtook me. And when I saw Blackout Tuesday, and I mean, social media turned into this like place of chaos where there was, I can't remember who quoted this, but where you're drowning in information, but everyone's seeking wisdom. And it's like everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And I thought to myself, it's like, you know, this is great, but what is actually happening when people put their phones down?
Yeah.
And they got to have conversation with their white spouse and their white kids and their white bosses and their white team and like their white parents. Like, is that actually happening? Because that was the missing link for me this entire time. It was like, obviously, like for me internally, be like, obviously I am against racism. And then I'd be done. Like I'd see something. Right. I'm like, nope, that's not me. Like I don't associate with that. But by not actually doing anything differently or, you know, challenging my thoughts or anything like that, nothing was actually changing in a global way. Because I think we'd all go back to our safe households and, you know, we'd get over our shock and horror of what we saw in the news that day, and we'd just go back to our life.
Yeah, you can't get over the impact that the new information has. And you can't just like ignore it anymore.
You can't ignore it. You can't unsee it. You can't unfeel it. And I have no idea how any business right now could go on without understanding things to this magnitude anymore.
They do. They just don't care.
They don't. Well, that's just it, right? And it's been wild.
Yep.
For so many reasons. What was the most surprising to me was all these people in my industry who I looked up to for years,
my own,
you know, personal development, you know, people I really idolize in the world of online business, big names. And it's like, that's how I knew I got it. It finally clicked for me, because I could see it in them, the deflection and the defensiveness. And I'm like, they're doing what I used to do.
Right.
Because this still hasn't clicked for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in brand protection mode instead of, you know, listening and learning mode.
Correct.
And I mean, for lack of a better word, these women got taken out.
Yeah.
Like taken out.
Yeah.
And I'm watching like, holy smokes, like the empire just crumbled in like 48 hours, because they weren't willing to challenge themselves and be like, hey, there seems to be a lot of Black people that are not happy with me right now. Maybe I should look a little deeper into this instead of trying to defend why I made a comment on something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they care more about their brand. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard of something, it was a social, I can't remember. He's a motivational speaker in the UK. I think his name is Paul Stanton. I am sorry, Paul, if I don't have the right last name, but he talked about something when in the white community where it's a social understanding, one of two things that happens, like let's say in this example here, the racist joke. And he understands that if he doesn't laugh or allows it to happen, it could affect his pockets. Like it could affect his social hierarchy in terms of, social capitalism. That's what he said. Social capitalism in the white culture.
Social capital. Yeah.
Social capital. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
He understood that he was about to hear a racist joke, and if he says something about it, it's going to affect his social capital.
Yeah, totally. And that works for like patriarchy, works for misogyny, works for all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why, like, when you hear that term locker room talk.
Yes.
Those are white men, old white men naked in front of each other being totally unhinged.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah.
But then justifying it because it's just locker room talk.
Right.
It's not harming anyone.
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of other white men in there too, right?
Yeah. Right. Just normalizing it. Yeah.
So you're seeing because like you have a community and you're a leader in your community, right?
Yeah.
And so you're seeing the people that you look up to or fellow motivational speakers or people who do what you do, you're seeing their world crumbling. Was it a moment for you like, oh, okay, I need to make some changes? Is like, what happened? What did you think when you started seeing their world crumbling like this?
Well, it's actually something where intuitively something just shifted in me before this crumble happened. And my assistant that works for me, she's like, you felt something after George Floyd's murder, that like something snapped. And if you go look on my social media, you'll see that I took ownership for my absolute shortcomings as a white woman community leader before any of these other big industry powerhouses even knew what was going on.
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah.
So it's like when I was watching them, it wasn't so much of like, oh God, I better go make sure I'm okay because I see what's happening here. I was looking on in sheer disappointment that for two things, disappointment in how they were responding, but disappointment in myself for following their lead for so many years.
Right.
There were occasions where when I would feel like, God, like I don't know how to diversify, like, I don't know how, this is hard, like, I don't know what to do. And then I would look to the people that I really admired in my industry, and they weren't going out of their way to be inclusive,
right,
or to be accepting, which in turn sent me a message that it's like, don't be so hard on yourself. Like,
right,
look at all these other big players. They're not making a big deal out of it. Why are you, you know, trying to, you know, being so hard on yourself, especially in your first year of business. So I would use their white platforms as justification to not be so stressed out about the fact that I had a white platform.
Right.
So when this was happening, I realized, I'm like, oh my God, I have been following their lead. So I kind of pictured it like a chain, right? So I'm like the entrepreneur that's coming up and really learning from all the masters. And it was like, I don't want to be that person for all of the white women who are looking up to me as a community creator. I don't want more white women to say, oh, look, it's okay to have a white community because look at what the great Canadian woman has.
Right.
Right. So there was like this thing that clicked in me. It's like, we're breaking the cycle.
Mm.
Otherwise, if I don't use my voice, which now I understand what is meant by saying use your privilege to help. It's like, if I don't use my voice, then I'm literally just, by not doing anything, I'm continuing this cycle of white communities.
Yeah.
So that's where I started to really, really put in the effort and more importantly, the ownership. Because what I saw coming from a lot of other brands was like, all of a sudden they had this like action plan. And I'm like, how do you have an action plan if it's been 4 days? Like, how have you done enough internal work to understand this, to understand whether or not your action plan is actually the action plan you need?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where I had to be okay with, you know, people potentially looking at my brand, waiting for some sort of action plan to come out, and be okay with taking the time to learn and wrap my head around all of this before I come out with some big public action plan statement.
Right.
Because even, so it's interesting, Shirley, even in the Uncomfortable Conversation podcast episodes,
yeah.
As I continue to learn, especially reading White Fragility and watching documentaries, it's like even my language and my thought process has shifted even since our conversation.
Yeah.
And I'd be like thinking of things, but maybe a question I asked him, like, oh my God, you know, because it's like, but it's like, that's, I feel like it's the necessary, almost like an incubation period that I have to go through right now,
yeah,
internally, in order to outwardly produce the things that need to be produced in my community and change the things that need to be changed. Otherwise, I'm just slapping an action plan out there.
Yeah.
And then getting praised for it, which I don't think changes anything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Being part of the cycle that creates those like white spaces, it's like almost sometimes, it's like you sometimes realize that you're part of the cycle, like you can see it, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
you can get called out on it and stuff like that. And it's at that moment, if you're a person who actually cares about other people, it's that moment that you're going to tell yourself, like, either you don't care about the impact or you do.
Right.
You know what I mean? About how this like unfolds like at so many more levels, right? And if you do care about the impact, then you're going to do things very much like Sarah's been doing and looking into it and you know, doing some work to getting caught up and things like that. And it's important.
Definitely. Because
it changes how you think. It changes how you interact in the world. It changes how you see shared spaces. It's all of
I'm
that.
I'm snapping. Yeah. And in the language, because it's so fun, it's so true, because when you and I connected about a year and you reached out to me in the DM for in Black Canadian content creators, and I remember, and I spoke of this on your show, I could see what you're doing. I also was excited for you.
Full disclosure, when Shirley told me that, I was pretty upset.
can you make me so sad?
I was like, does she have your PayPal?
Yeah, that's yeah, real. He's like, you getting paid? I was like,
good for you, hubby. Good for you.
But I was like, I don't want to be used as a token. But I could see what she's doing. I see some of the similarities, but yet differences of what we're doing. And I was like, I felt this sense of, oh, this is really cool, but I just can't infuse myself in this space because based on the language or the approach or whatever, I'm like, I don't want to get hurt. I have to protect myself, right? And then now with what is everything that's happening and what you're doing with Uncomfortable Conversation, it's I could see that you are doing the work internally, not just for yourself. I mean, you've been starting to do it way before everything that's going on now.
Yeah, you put your own gas mask on first before you try and put it on others. Yeah.
There you go. And that's what it is. That's the stage that you're at with your community. Like you're like, as you're, you know, continuing to kind of understand the intricacies of your gas mask.
Yeah.
That you're saying, hey, there's a gas mask, everyone. You know?
Yeah.
You know?
And let me figure this out within myself, right? Before I start, you know, tossing around information. It's just, I don't know.
And the white lash that you got from your group. Can you speak a little bit about that?
White lash. There's a new term. I get it though. Well, I have a countless number of examples within the last month alone where I got the same response, like verbatim. They just switched out the names of their Black friends that they were referencing.
Wow.
In response to me having a conversation with them, maybe sharing new knowledge that I had, or maybe helping them see why maybe you shouldn't just refer to it as we're just one human race. Mm-hmm. Maybe you shouldn't use hashtag All Lives Matter. Every single one of them, there's no exception, 100% of the white people that I engaged in this conversation with, instead of hearing what I was saying, they immediately gave me a list of Black people and Indigenous people that were their friends or their colleagues.
Or that agreed with them.
Right. And I was like, oh my God, like I could see it, you know?
Yeah.
Person after person after person. And I'm like, so annoyed with white people. Like all of a sudden I'm like, this is obnoxious. Like, but you know, it also gave me a slight teeny, 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 teeny glimpse into what Black and colored and Indigenous communities have been up against. Because like I'm trying to have these conversations with white people for a month, I'm like, you guys are driving me bananas. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to, you know, you spend your whole life doing this. So it's like, it just gave me such a tiny little
perspective,
thought of an idea of what this must be like, because I was irritated to the point of exhaustion trying to get people to understand. And, you know, but every single one of them would say, I'm not racist. I'm not racist. I'm not racist. I'm like, I know, but you're not hearing my point. You're not hearing the concept of anti-racism. You're not hearing the concept of seeing color and seeing differences. Like it's just whoo, right over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But that was the thing that was probably, you know, the second worst thing to have to realize is like, I started to understand things, and then as I'd be absorbing all this information, I put my phone down and I would feel the heaviness of what I knew I needed to do.
Right.
Because otherwise I just know things.
Yeah.
And then I'm not actually doing anything different or changing anything or having different dialogue with my friends and family. And then I'm not doing anything. I'm just continuing to be part of the problem. So it's like, there was this other realization where it's like, oh my God, like my world has to shift.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's this mourning phase I think I went through.
Yeah.
Where my whole life as I knew it wasn't as it should have been.
Right.
And all the things that I believed to be true based on what I was taught in school and stuff, a lot of it's not real, and a whole lot more of it was left out. And it's like, there was a period of a week where I was spinning because I didn't know what the hell was real.
Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that
conditioning is real.
Yeah. Yeah. And it made me question everything. And I was talking to my sister about it. She's in fitness and nutrition, graduated in nutrition from university, personal trainer. And as she started to learn she was like, she started trying to understand her industry more.
Mm. Oh yeah. Okay.
She realized that there's so much Black history when it comes to the world of nutrition and body types.
Huh. Yeah.
That were not in her studies at all.
There you go.
Yeah. That's
so true. She went through this period of like wicked anger because she spent so many years in post-secondary and all of this new information that she was researching and actively looking for. She was like, how dare you not teach this? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah,
it's real. Yeah.
Yeah. It's gotten to the point. Real. It's gotten to the point in some places, in North America where like the selecting and choosing of what gets taught has entered into the realm of like science where like teachers will wait until the end of the learning lesson before they get into things like science and numeracy and stuff like that. And that's just because of their own beliefs. Right. And I'm a huge believer that your beliefs inform your actions. So if you are doing performative allyship when it comes to Black liberation, then you're not really doing it for the right reason at all.
And you see it in the action based on it's so subtle, but it's other, whether you're Black, Indigenous, or person of color, and you see, like you said, brands who does performative allyship, right?
Right, right. Because they don't get it, but they understand they better say Black Lives Matter and toot sweet. Right. They better say it quick or it's going to get really bad.
But,
so they do that.
Yep.
And then they just kind of like for the wrong reasons. Yeah. And they just like, well, but we said Black Lives Matter. We're not racist anymore. It's like,
we made an Instagram post.
Right. We changed our cover to be just a Black picture.
Right. But then even the picture they'll use, they're not understanding like, well, let's examine the picture you chose.
Right.
Let's look at the words that you have chosen to use into your marketing or into whatever. And they're like, what do you mean? Like, this is what this says. I'm like, yeah, but what you said here has a deep issue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, like I'm going to use the Aunt Jemima example of a brand where it's like, first of all, it's 131 years old.
130 years old of fucking with people.
So think about all fucking with Black people the whole history time. Of 131 years, right? And then for them, they're thinking, okay, we'll change her picture to not be no longer the mammy picture, right? With the hair wrap or whatever, but like a thinner, you know, Black.
More like a maid.
Not even like they even remove the maid part. They actually remove the maid part.
So, it's maid uniform.
It's her from the neck up. But they're not understanding. Like, yeah, but it don't matter if you like her picture looks like Naomi Campbell. You know what
I mean? The history behind it's
the name and the history. Like it's all of that, right? So it's like I said, if you could tell a brand like I'm going to use Ben and Jerry's where. When Trayvon Martin, what happened to Trayvon Martin, Ben & Jerry's was one of the first brands that like got on it right away.
Shout out to Ben & Jerry's.
Really got it right. But you could tell that it wasn't coming from them. You could tell that they've been doing the work and that all of us were like, who are they talking to? Who's educating them?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, wow. Like who's giving them homework?
Yeah.
You know? And it's doesn't mean like again, like I don't think they probably change much of their structure, but you could tell
soon, honey. Love you.
Sorry, little one. That that homework is being done, that they are including a team to explain to them the history of understanding anti-racism.
Yeah, and a big part of that is them willing to listen.
Yes.
Them caring enough about the people they share space with to hear. And listen and to know that their experience, their lived experience is not the privileged lived experience of everyone.
Yeah.
It's not. Yeah. And that's what, you know, the conversation that usually when I get into them, it's usually along the lines of like, do you not see that things are not equal? They're not. And it's at that point where people start to talk about if they care if they're equal or not.
Yeah.
And it's like, you should care if they're equal, because if they're not equal for somebody someday, they won't be equal for you another day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, like, to go back, you're saying you could tell that there was a pattern with people around you or in your group saying, like, some of my, like, here are the list of my Black friends and I'm not racist. How do you, I know it's different for you because you're white, right? So the level of protectiveness is far lower than if it's coming from me, you know?
Right.
How did you, are you continuing to push through that within your community? Or is it like, how do you, what made you figure doing something like, was basically the uncomfortable conversation a catalyst to what you're seeing in terms of the feedback you're getting?
Yeah, I think that the Uncomfortable Conversation series, my goal for it was kind of twofold. It's first and foremost to provide an educational platform for white people because they listen to me. Mm. And I know that they tune in. I know that they hear what I say. So if I can bring that education and these voices into this space, then they're more likely to absorb that information if it's coming through a white channel, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, it totally does.
Right? The other piece of it is helping other white women, so the women who are listening, to understand that I'm incredibly uncomfortable and this is not easy for me as the leader of a community to have to face off with. And if they can see that it's not going to be easy, that if it is easy, you're probably not going as deep enough into your learning as you should be, then it will give them permission to do the hard things too, and to have the hard conversations with themselves and to have the hard conversations with their friends and families and right. to, you know, make it a little more receptive and a little bit more, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, enable them, you know what I mean? Enable them to do something as a white woman. Mm. So that was kind of, there was like two purposes for the series. One is like, we've got the ears, let's bring in the voices. Mm. The other one was like, white woman here in an incredibly vulnerable state, willing to look like a complete idiot right now for the sake of doing better. What's your excuse?
Right,
you know,
right.
if you're not, if you think that you're trying to get through this without, you know, getting scathed in any way, or get through it without having to, you know, make a public statement without serious work also backing it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been, the reception from the podcast has been really beautiful because there's so many white people that are waking up to this right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I said in, I think it was one of the book club calls that we were on, is like, there's, I don't think it's ever been easier right now for white people to learn this.
Yeah, it's like,
there's no excuse. All there. It's all there.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not doing this work now, it's very telling to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. It means you don't care.
Yeah, it's very telling. And I think that that's been
It's two
the
things.
Eye-opener.
You don't care. Or you don't want to, like, you understand your privilege and you don't want to let it go.
That's because they don't care about the lives that it
right.
costs.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Because to have true equality means that you have to let go of your privilege or utilize it in a different positive way for equality.
Yeah, I was in a conversation, or there was a presentation done by the 519 in Toronto. Mm. And the person, the person sitting next to me was like, oh, my God, I'm really uncomfortable right now. I don't know what to say. And I'm like, good. Means you got some learning to do. Come on.
Yeah.
That's why I use the example of the muscle all the time, right?
Yeah, it is. It's totally.
The reward after is that you look, if you feel fine, you look good.
Yeah.
It's the same way with like, now we will have an embrace of a much more colorful world, you know, that's where everyone starts at the same line. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I've heard stories where I felt that, like, you know, being a Black woman and you give birth to a Black son and you feel yay, but at the same time, a fear right away. And it's like, shouldn't be like that.
No, not at all.
You know? So, and I enjoyed the experience of being on your show, because it's funny, you're saying you're being a guinea pig in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I have to say, I listened to the show again. And I mean, even myself, sometimes I talk and I'm like, hey, I'm learning. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm learning because I felt that you're a filter, you know?
Yes.
There are languages and things during our conversation when I listened to it that you, as a white woman, were able to summarize.
To white people.
Yes. Yeah. To kind of make the blow a little less, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense.
Do you get what I'm saying?
I totally get what you're saying, because when you have like a Black person with a megaphone saying, yelling Black Lives Matter, the white response to that is like, oh, Jesus. Okay, here we go again, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But if you got white people doing this, then it's like, wait, what?
Hold up.
Wait.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
There's a difference. There's a difference.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something with all of the interviews that I've recorded so far, is there's a part of my mind when you're speaking, it's like, what is the white argument to this?
Yes!
Like, what is the pushback that the listeners are likely thinking, or maybe rolling their eyes to? I mean, these are the ones that aren't tuning in for the sake of really learning. Like, people are just listening to me like, I was told I needed to listen to this podcast, and they're there out of obligatory reasons. The white argument. So Clove, when you said the filter, like it's like, I think, or sorry, it was usually the filter.
See, Sarah,
what?
Sarah, see how Sarah picked that up?
What picked what up?
There's just a lot of, she's like, Shirley, filter. Like, she got it. But it's those little things. Like, in my world, in corporate world, it would just go, like, I'm in a, you know, being in an interracial relationship, I say something, and right away people give credit to Clove, because he's a white man. You know what I mean? But you picked it up. It's just these little subtle things.
Little things.
Right.
But little anyway, things. Sorry I interrupted. But yes, the filter,
But I think, like, that's the thing, right? And that's what I've realized with, you know, my own education is, oh God, out of all the people I've been listening to over the last month, it was somebody said something that the oppressed can't unoppress themselves. The oppressor has to remove the oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I was like, what the hell? Have we had such a hard time understanding this? And, you know, when I'm reading White Fragility, which I think was probably the perfect place for me to start, because I had to understand why I had such a hard time seeing this before I dive into learning more about history and all these. I had to understand, like, why my white self would not absorb this until now. And what I'm learning in that book, it's just been so eye-opening to me. Yeah. And that's what's making me question everything. Like, when they reference Thomas Jefferson did a scientific study, and his scientific question that he asked was, why are Black people inferior? Not are Black people inferior?
Wow.
Why are they?
Yeah.
So even just that one word.
It changes the way, like, his belief.
Changes the outcome. And when you think about quote unquote scientific studies, these are things that were deemed as scientific studies.
Yeah.
And then taught to us, you know, and like, it just, it's a wormhole. I'm not going to lie, because like one thing leads to another, but
Yeah, you're going to uncover, you're going to uncover a whole world of anti-blackness and white supremacy. And it's always this, it's always this exercise to try and use fucked up racial bias, like scientific quote unquote data. And they put new words to it and they try and reintroduce it. And it's just like, maps. It's this cycle that can only happen from the position of being in a white supremacy.
I mean, in one of the jokes, my brother and I, when we were young, or not even young, not too long ago, like even going to the bathroom and you have those automatic faucets, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, and we're like, that's even racist. Why is it taking so long to like the water coming out when I have my hand, you know, the dark side? But then later you're like, well, it is structured that way. Mm. You know, I have a better, water comes out a little faster when I have I use my palm instead of my, but it's real because, and then it's like, it's so small, right? Yeah. But it's, if it's structured by predominantly.
Yeah. Everything around me as a white man is built for my success, is built for my access.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's all gated just for me to like knock on the door and just like say, hey, I'd like to come in now. And they're like, sure, come on in, white guy.
But you know, but I'm going to say this too. I think also not the fact that you're creating your series, you're also in a way, and I've had this happen where there are conditioning is everywhere, right? So it's not just white people who are being conditioned, but everyone, right? You have, you know, now where you see the younger generation of South Asian communities saying you need to pull up because anti-blackness is real. And even there's a sense of anti-blackness within their own community and challenging their own caste system and things like that, right? So listening to your show also made me think that the conversation you're having is also giving language for Black, Indigenous, and people of color who themselves haven't challenged themselves on the reality of what's happening.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
Like,
that's a great point.
Do you know what I mean? Because I had a friend I was talking to, and they're like, I saw a post, and based on their industry, they're like, well, I don't want to like shake things up because of what I do. And that can affect the type of people who follow me and da 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 da. And I was like, no, listen to this series because it will provide you the language. So when someone says, I don't see color, you know what to say.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? Like, or those That's kind a great of things.
So we've had Sarah on the phone for an hour and a half now. I think maybe we should wrap things up and pick it up
we're gonna in another have to do conversation a second part.
Another time. Yeah.
So where can
people... I'll come back for sure.
Yeah. Yes. So, so right now you're doing the Uncomfortable Conversation. How many parts is this series and where can people listen?
Yeah, we've got 10 scheduled so far and they'll span for a period of 2 to 3 months. And then we'll see from there. They can tune in anywhere, any major podcast platform.
A Great Canadian Woman Podcast.
Great Canadian Woman Podcast. Tune in. There's just so many things that we're learning right now about our own operations that, you know, the way that I described it to my team was we have two ways we can look at this. We can look at it as, wow, we've really screwed this up and we can be hard on ourselves, or we can find a way to be grateful that we've been awakened to this because now we can do better. And that's really exciting for us is to know that we can do better going forward. So we're excited about all the things that are starting to kind of trickle in as ideas for where to take things moving forward, which means that basically our entire 2020 plan was thrown up in the air at the beginning of 2020 with COVID-19 anyway. But this was kind of like that next level we needed to be knocked. In order to really understand how to create a truly inclusive and accepting community that will be felt and not just something that is seen, or it's not just, you know, visually aesthetic or on point for branding. We want it to be felt. So we're excited about that.
I'm excited.
I'm excited too.
I am excited too. And then right now your group is going doing the book club with for yeah. the white fragility.
And that's going to become a thing that's we've already decided that, you know, regardless of whatever else we have to shift gears in our business, the book club is permanent. So we're going to have, you know, multiple book clubs going on at the same time, even Netflix documentaries, to have, you know, group discussions around. We're actually building all the infrastructure for that on our website. So it's formal. People can nice. Sign up. People can take part in chat forums on the website. We're constructing all of that right now. So it's not just living out of a Facebook group,
nice.
But we've had two calls already for our first book. Third one is this coming Tuesday. And I mean, I have nothing to gauge it on and whether or not it's doing awesome or doing terribly, but it feels as though it's doing what I wanted it to do, which is to just get a lot of white people together who weren't engaging in these conversations before mm-hmm. to engage in these conversations now.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's been doing that. So I hope that the space is doing what I would like it to do, which is to create a safe space for white people to learn about the things that have either intimidated us in the past or we have ignored or we have been ignorant to, whether by choice or not, to have a space to come and talk these things out, and, you know, have a place to talk about the realizations we're having about ourselves mm-hmm. and the way that we operate and have been operating and things that have guided our decision-making process, like all yep. of that. It's all wrapped up in there. So I'm excited about that. That's a for sure to move forward with. The rest we have kind of on a big, big dry erase board right now, but nothing permanent yet, because I don't want, you know, anything to be made out of a knee-jerk reaction yeah. to appease the world of social media and beyond. Mm-hmm. Even though with two women on my team, I've got a partner that I just brought on this year, right after COVID and before this new, you know, racial adjustment, yeah. Injustice movement, Black Lives Matter, she's kind of right in the middle. So she, my partner, and my assistant, we're all doing this. We're all in this whole level of learning. So it's not just me in the organization and then hoping that all of my, you know, white employees and partners figure it out on their own, which is what I think is going to really make a difference, to be honest.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. People will see that. Thank you so much, Sarah. You could find Sarah at The Great Canadian Woman. Just go to thegreatcanadianwoman.ca. Making waves, move mountains.
Keep challenging whiteness.
Blaze trails. Yes. Yes. And just really making the shift and changes for humanity.
Yeah.
Because that's the bottom line. That's what it's about.
It is. Thanks so much for your time, Sarah. Stick around, and we're just going to do a quick sign out, and then we'll say our proper goodbyes.
Yes.
Well, that was a good conversation.
Yes.
Yes.
You have a quote?
I do not.
I have one.
Yes.
I kind of just like was listening to something, and I thought, I heard something, and I thought this was really good. It's not about your intention. It's about the reception.
Right.
Take into account other people's experiences. Believe them.
Yes.
That's the best you could do.
Correct.
Is start by believing them and start a conversation from there.
Yep. Impact is greater than intent. Icy Bailey.
Yes. Oh, rest in peace, Icy Bailey.
Take care, everybody. The conversation you wanted to have is happening.
Wait. You're still listening to podcasts? Well, if you love this episode of the Chonilla Podcast so much, just head over to iTunes or Spotify to subscribe and leave a review, I guess.